So if you have your paper copy of God's Word, all you have to do is open it to pretty much the first page or pull it up on your phone, Genesis chapter number 1. As we continue the series that we started talking about a faithful God amidst failing, even faltering people, that is the book of Genesis, a book of beginnings, a book of foundations, a blueprint book for us understanding God, us, and others. And so we started this a few weeks back, and we talked about in the beginning, from the beginning. And in this opening chapter, Moses captures God's revelation of himself as both good and powerful in his creative, miraculous works. So let's look at chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. We talked about last time just getting our feet grounded or feet into this book, understanding that we needed to know who wrote it. Well, the easy answer about who wrote it is what? It's Moses. We talked about other ideas. It's not widely accepted or thought of as anybody other than Moses for quite some time. It's only recently that's come under scrutiny. We deny it. Moses wrote the first five. Outside the last part about his death and his burial, we recognize at the end of Deuteronomy, somebody took up that for him under inspiration. All right. Then we talked about what purpose does it serve? Well, it serves a lot of purposes. Primarily, it's the first book of the Hebrew canon. It introduces us to the first part of the Torah, the first five books, the law. And so we understand that this is a book of big pictures. Well, what was the big picture or the purpose of the book? Well, it starts off by revealing the origin and purpose of the universe, of life, of humanity. It answers the deep questions that every single human being who's ever lived has. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going, right? Genesis gives you the understanding of those items. It shows you a personal, relational, covenant-making nature of our God. It records the early history of a Hebrew people. It begins revealing Jesus is our Messiah, and it starts showing history that's going to take place. It reveals the first several ways in which God dealt with humanity, with innocence in chapters 1 through 3, and then conscience in chapters 4 through 8. Then human government is established and shown in 9 through 11. And then there's the promise, not only with human government, but through a specific nation of Israel, Genesis chapter 12 onward, going throughout the rest of the book. And so that's how the book shows us its purpose and introduces us to God and his work in people's lives. Then we talked about what to consider with how it began. At verse number 1, the opening of God's recorded revelation to humanity is not an explanation. It's what? It's an introduction. In the beginning, God. You either accept God at the basis of a faith-based relationship or you reject it, but there is no in-between. There is no fudgy gray idea here. That's the dynamic between us and God. And frankly, let's be honest, that's the dynamic for any worldview, isn't it? It is a faith-based proposition, no matter if you're Christian, whether you're Muslim, whether you're Mormon, whether you're agnostic, whether you're atheist, you have some level of trust, if you don't want the word faith there, that your belief system is accurate and right for this life and the next if you even believe in one. Nothing's different when it comes to the Bible. It's a faith-based proposition. So then we kind of helped us understand that chapter 1 gives us the idea of philosophy and how it is refuted. We talked about atheism. Well, chapter 1 says there is a God. Polytheism, there's one God. Pantheism, he created all things. He's not intermingled in all things. Evolutionism, he is the one who created creation. He's not mingled in it, didn't just form on its own. He is outside of materialism or existentialism. So tonight, as we walk through the rest of chapter 1, familiar ground for you if you've been in church for any length of time or been a follower of Jesus for any length of time. But for those who aren't, particularly the younger generation, I want to remind you chapter 1 is pivotal to understanding the nature and activity of your God. And we should walk away tonight, even though it's familiar to us, if it is, encouraged about the God of chapter number 1. Why? Because there's three words really that are going to come into play tonight as we walk through the creation days there, 1 through 6. Three words that help you and I in our walk with God and our thankfulness really to who he is. Order, function, and purpose. Order, function, and purpose. As you go through chapter 1, those things are expressed over and over and over and over again. Order, function, and purpose. And these principles are seen throughout this early portion. So nobody says there in the beginning, as we said last time, that implies there will be a creation at the beginning and a conclusion with the Creator at the end. So we open up here, not only did he create everything from nothing, he's the one who's all powerful, but then note what he says here in verse number 2. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. God is our Creator. And as our Creator, he did not need our permission, nor did he need any aid or help in what he created. In fact, this Hebrew word creation is that force or that sense that he did it all of his own ability and good pleasure. He didn't need anything else. That just shows the transcendence between God and us. There's really nothing that you or I can do that creates anything that didn't derive its origin from something else in some way, right? Yeah, God is not limited like you and I are. That's why this word created is here. The idea is out of nothing. And as we start seeing through chapter 1, that which is unproductive becomes productive. That which is uninhabited becomes habited. He works throughout the 6 days to express this again and again and again. I especially want to speak to the younger generation here when I say, with his creation, I want to challenge you to stand firm as a creationist, but explore the different views or the different sciences in line there with your view. What I mean is, when we go to some of the sciences, whether it's cosmology, anthropology, biology, it doesn't matter the science you choose, recognize that whether you believe in creationism or evolutionism, as you approach this, there's going to be theories, and I want you to look in those sciences and realize that there is so much evidence, indisputable at times evidence, of your Creator God, and you're not a weirdo or a minority, though we're becoming an increasing minority, of believing in God as the Creator, that he did what he promised he did, he said what he promised he could do, and he did it, my friends. I want to challenge you, especially sometimes, depending on your upbringing or background, sometimes you feel like, oh no, can't read anything that's contrary to creationism. Oh no. No, I would encourage you, do that. Be familiar, be aware with what's going on, and realize how much evidence is out there and how many theories are just postulated that really have no legs that you hear blasted all the time. So when we read that God created, let's evaluate theories, let's ask good questions, let's question the assumption, let's admit times where our faith view is unsure or unclear, and let's expect there to be real evidence that does align with what God promised in his word. But that said, I'll say this again at the end, evidence gets interpreted differently depending on your worldview. Two people can look at the exact same set of evidence and come with wildly different conclusions. And we might say, well, that's not true. In fact, there is an idea out there that's associated with this. It's called underdetermination thesis. The idea is two people can look at it because there is not full evidence on either side. Their background, their ideology, their worldview, whether it's Christian or non, comes in and reinterprets it and leads to different conclusions from the exact same evidence. So my friends, I want you from the very beginning to realize that God said he created. Hold that view in faith and let it be challenged. Work through it, walk through it, and see the evidence along the way. Now, as we get into verses 1 and 2, it says that God creates the heaven and the earth. The idea there is the totality of the universe. He goes on to talk about it as without form and void, and the Spirit of God moved on the face of the deep. Now, I'd be careful here, and I'm not going to spend any time really here. Sometimes people try to get this to be some pre-endemic race and whatnot. I just ignore all that, flush all that, and move on beyond that. In that early session here, God creates an opportunity there where he puts light there. Not the sun, that's later on, but he creates this source of light. And then day one, know what happens in verses 1 through 5, verse 3. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And evening and morning were the first day. Now, it was originally covered in newly created water, and there was darkness all around. And then God says what? Let there be light. Again, not the sun. He does that later. And we might wonder, how could this be? God's the one who's the author and originator of light. He's the one who creates it. And in that very first day, all that was needed for there to be a day and night was what? Light separating from darkness, the rotation of the globe. He moves on to day two, verses six through eight. On day two, he divides the water. Now, I want you to catch this. He does water and he does the atmosphere on day two. And what he says here in verse six, God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and morning were the second day. This word firmament refers to space and expanse called heaven. On this day here, the Lord is doing what? He's putting a gap. He's putting a space, creating the atmosphere. Some may ask the question, which wisely if you are, you're asking, if he creates the atmosphere, then he talks about putting water out into the expanse. What does that mean? Well, for a while, there was a popular theory called the vapor canopy theory. Any homeschoolers in the room remember that? Maybe a few of you do along the way, right? Vapor canopy theory. It's fallen out of favor. There's a whole other theory about the water being out there in space by evolutionists and creationists under the idea of cosmic radiation background. You can go read that later. When you can't sleep tonight, just pull that up on the internet. It is fascinating and above my pay grade. So you want to read about that? That's some people's idea about what this even means. And so there is a support for creationism through that. There's also a support for evolution through that. CMB. So you can do that later if you want. God does that day two. Day three is when maybe we start seeing more of what we can relate to on the visual realm. And day number three, in verses 9 through 13, see what God does here in verse number 9. God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place. Let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he the seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb-yielding seed, and the fruit tree, yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and herb-yielding seed after its kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the third day. So as we come to day three, we see God separate land from the water. Maybe we'd call that Pangea. You can look that up, read a little bit about that from back in the day. Both creation and the idea of evolution support that. And so it wouldn't be until the flood that we'd see that tectonic movement there. So day three, you have land, but that's not alone. Now the dry land also has what? Plants, fruit trees, grass, you name it. You and I can relate to seeing it. And it's important we recognize God and his order, his function, his purpose does what? That each of these things reproduces after its kind. Now, to put that in perspective for you, there are over 375,000 species of living plants known to exist. I found it interesting. I'm no botanist, but I read a little bit about this to see that they don't feel like they ever have had a clear classification in one way or another, combining all of the 375,000 varieties. There's either disagreement about where they belong or they discover something new. And so there's not even agreement, but that's how many species they say of living plants there are. Now, this is what's interesting to me. I want you to think about some of the most beautiful plants or the fruit trees, flowers, whatever it is. I've got a black thumb. I can just kill everything. I don't have a green thumb to produce anything. You name it, I can kill it. It's wonderful. So don't trust me with your plants or your house plants, right? So here it is. I want you to think about your best one you've ever made. Some people it's your rose bushes. Some people it's maybe a fruit tree you had, whatever it is. You don't have a green thumb. Maybe you do. At the end of the day, I want you to think about your favorite and think about what you've never seen on it. So is anybody a rose fan in the room? Three whole people. How many of you are fruit tree people? Right? I'm not trying to be silly here, but consider this. God in his kindness not only created so many different species of all that we see on the dry land and the visual cornucopia that it is to see these different items, Then you talk about all the functionality. There's some that are just pretty. They serve no purpose. Some are incredibly important for pollination and a whole cycle there. Some create what? Edible items for us to enjoy. So you have things that just look nice, things that serve purpose, some that serve purpose to you and I as well, some to other animals and certain animals, certain insects. So here's what I want you to recognize. There's a massive amount of variety that God in his kindness gave, not only for our visual thankfulness to him, but also our physical sustainment or the environmental sustainment around us. Now, I bring that up to say there is the idea, again, in evolution, that everything from a single cell organism went from there. That includes everything, friends. That's not just living life like you and I as anthropoids. It's beyond that. It's talking about every single thing has to have transitioned in some evolutionary mechanism through macro evolution. I like the way one author said it. He said it like this: as a whole, the fossil evidence of prehistoric plants is actually very good, yet no convincing transitional forms have been discovered in the abundant plant fossil record. This fact has been recognized by both creationists and evolutionists, providing strong evidence for abrupt appearance theory. If macroevolution were true, some evidence of plant evolution should exist in the abundant plant fossil record. Instead, what is found are many examples of modern plants, variations of modern plants, or extinct plants that would still require more transitional forms for the gap to be filled. What am I just trying to encourage us from, just from this day alone and day three, is that you don't see the jumps. You don't see it in the fossil record. You don't see it to this day. You don't see it at all. God, in his kindness, created it for us to enjoy, and it wasn't a process through a mechanism of macro jumping evolution. I like the one author had to admit, his name's Harry Boyd. He's known for authoring a variety of works in this field. Here's what he said when they had a group of botanists and other scientists together. He said, after carefully weighing the currently available evidence of comparative morphology, cytology, biochemistry, and fossil record, are at present unwilling to amalgamate any two or more of the 19 divisions in which they have tentatively classified the organisms of the plant kingdom. When and if additional relevant data becomes available, such amalgamations will undoubtedly be required. But at this time, there are no known living or fossil forms that unequivocally link any two of the proposed divisions. You know what this man was saying, who was an expert in his field as an atheistic person? He said, I want to show a jump, but you know what I can't show? A jump. It's what I believe. It's what I teach. It's what he was an expert in, wrote. You can go and Google his name. You'll see he wrote extensively about this subject. And yet he said, even when they came together with the intentional process to discover, show, manifest, they could not make the link. What I'm just trying to press into our mind is, again, God in his creativity did what with creation? Order, function, and purpose. We come to day 4 in verses 14 through 19. Look at verse 14, see what it says. And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let there be signs for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser night to rule the night, and he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw it was good. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. Here God does what? He fills, if you want to say it this way, outer space as we understand it and as we know it. And he created the sun, moon, and stars for two very distinct reasons, as we see. Signs and seasons for days and years. So we know God helped us understand, even from the early time, before you had a phone to tell you what time it was, you could track the time and you could track the seasons with what? Just the stars, with the astronomy, with the seasons, things of that nature. Again, order, function, and purpose. You had the ability now to not only see in the day, but also see in the night because of the sun and the moon and how that functioned with us here on earth. Again, order, function, purpose. We jump to day 5, verse 20, and look what he says here. Moses writes, and God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creatures that hath life, and the fowl, that they may fly above the earth in the open firmament of the heavens. And God created great wells, and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw it was very good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, fill the waters and the seas, and the fowls multiply in the earth. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. Here, what does God create? He gives all the oceans their inhabitants. He gives the air their inhabitants. He tells them to what? Procreate, reproduce. Now, the young people who are in the room, I say the really young people, help me out. What, if you were under the age of 12, what's one of your favorite land animals? Wrong day, never mind. What's one of your favorite ocean animals? Yes. You're an ocean animal? Whales. They do spit water out of their back. Yeah, they do, right? How many have ever had the chance to see a whale up close, right? Huge, majestic, incredible. Or you think, what in the world? How do these things just find enough krill to stay alive, right? You know, you think about the tons and tons of krill it takes for these things to stay alive. Somebody else, a younger person, what's one of your favorite things in the air or in the ocean? Sharks. It's one of your favorites? Ooh, yeah. It's incredible, right? How many of you have ever been snorkeling and seen a shark and panicked? Yeah. How many of you were embarrassed to realize later it's just like a nurse shark and it wasn't going to do anything to you, right? Yeah, I had one of those moments myself. It's like, ooh, and then it's like, oh, it's just docile. It's just getting out there. It doesn't even do anything like that. All right. Now, I want you to think about this. Kind of like with the trees and the flowers, the grass, when you think about what's in the ocean, and many of you who are readers know, how much of the ocean have we discovered? Very, very little. Very, very little. So what we do see and know about the ocean and how incredible it is with the variety of creatures and what they can do and all what they can survive in their habitats. And then you start talking about what's in the air as well. So diverse, such a variety, and they reproduce again after their kind. So creative over and over. Now, evolution likes to do what? Assert that there's a fossil record intact. Some will even use the word impeccable fossil record intact, demonstrating species crossover. Again, macroevolution. And so I was reading this afternoon about one individual trying to prove the evidence between lizards and turtles. And not only that, but showing between fish going into some level of birds. And again, what we find is this. Over and over, the individuals who make that claim of macro jumps in these capacities have to continue to rely on very weak fossil linkage, if not continually changing linkage in this. And what do they have to say? Well, we have to realign. I had to chuckle. I was reading this article this afternoon by a very well-known evolutionist. And he just kept saying, well, every once in a while, the theories have to be realigned to the new evidence. And he cited a string of things they've had to realign since the evidence. But those things were rock solid before. Now we have to realign. I'm not trying to just take pot shots here. I'm wanting us to realize how you view the evidence is based on your worldview. And what you're saying about the evidence will either be undermined perpetually because of your theories or can be demonstrated over time. But they're both still theories. It's been some years ago, back in 1980, there's a group of evolutionists who met in Chicago to discuss the relationship between micro and macro evolution. It was led by a very popular man at the time named Roger Lewin. And what Roger Lewin and his group summed up said this, you see it on the screen. The central question of our Chicago conference was whether the mechanism underlying microevolution can be extrapolated to explain the phenomena of macroevolution. Now, at the risk of doing violence to the positions of some of the people at the meeting, the answer can be given as a clear no. What's he saying? Oh, we came together on purpose, experts in our field, and I hate to demean my colleagues or cause them frustration, but here's our answer as scientists. We can't prove the theory we hold as the basis of all our scientific endeavors. The lack of clear relationship between micro and macro evolution is a continued problem for evolutionists, not only the fossil record, but any evidence beyond that, any functionality beyond that, any recent evidences of that as well. I'm not trying to take pot shots. I'm trying to remind us, as many in the room, if not all, are familiar with the creation account, what happened when. Let's remember the three words: order, function, purpose. Order, function, purpose. And just because we hear the drumbeat constantly about, well, you just are here, it just kind of happened, you just kind of evolved, there's evidence, ample evidence everywhere of macro species jumping evolution. Realize that's debatable in their own camp, if not deniable in their own camp. It's certainly easily debunked in many ways in our own. Read, for sure, think, for sure, question the assumption, but recognize the case is not as airtight as it's regularly presented to us. Day 6, 24 through 31. God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after his kind, cattle, creeping thing, and beasts on the earth after his kind. It was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw it was good. We'll tackle this more in depth next week in this next section. God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God made man in his own image. In the image of God created him, male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. We come to day 6 and we find all the land creatures and humanity crafted and created by the genius of God. And here is the crux of so much of what we see and hear in our culture. It really becomes the underlying issue of so many sociological ills as well. Is the mechanism macroevolution, single cell organism onward, jumping, morphing, changing, species to species to species, to where at the current situation, humanity is just the most evolved primate possible? Did macroevolution take place? Or can we step back and say, as creationists, we recognize after its kind, there is containment there, but there is adaptation through microevolution, again, in the spatial range. And we would say, yes. I like the way John Morris of Institute for Creation Research summed up. He said this: macroevolution refers to major evolutionary changes over time, the origin of new types of organisms from previously existing but different ancestral types. Examples of this would be fish descending from an invertebrate animal, or whales descending from a land mammal. The evolutionary concept demands these bizarre changes. However, microevolution refers to varieties within a given type. Change happens within a group, but the descendant is clearly the same type as the ancestor. This might better be called variation, adaptation, but the changes are horizontal, not vertical. Such changes might be accomplished by natural selection, which a trait within the present variety is selected as the best type given for the conditions and accomplished by artificial selection, such as when dog breeders produce a new kind of dog, they don't produce a new kind of what? Anything else. It's always the same in a micro way. Now, somebody may push back here and say, well, what about when there's genetic mutations? Well, we won't get into the weeds except to say genetic mutations still receive a loss of information and are not usually, if ever, proven to be viable in what they pass on. There are very few instances that can even be observed, and even then, there's a loss of data transmission. So we want to recognize that there's a great leap there. One author said it like this: evolutionists assume that small horizontal microevolutionary changes, which are observable, lead to vertical macroevolutionary changes, which have never been observed. This philosophical leap of faith lies at the very crux of evolutionary thinking. So again, I would stress to us, particularly to the younger brothers and sisters in the room, at school, your teacher and their ideology is telling you, here's undisputable fact. Macroevolution is why you're sitting here. It's why you even have the capacity to have brain power. You are at a level, a biological miracle, and you are a wet machine, or as Brother Steve told us at the men's camp out, a meat robot, right? You're just a combination of bones, skin, and chemical responses that are just the height of evolution. That's why you're here right now. I would push back to you and just remind you, you have a creative, all-powerful God who lovingly did what he did and allows there to be what you see and enjoy and have because of his wonderful ability. Our counterparts who deny creation usually fall back on theories and hypotheticals as their defense as they criticize us for doing the same. This is an interesting excerpt I had from one evolutionist writing on macroevolution. Here's what he said. Finally, the argument that this pathway, the pathway he was trying to show or prove in lizards to turtles, is meaningless because it's partially hypothetical, misses the whole point, because it's absolutely fine to use hypotheticals to defeat absolute claims. Creationists claim that macroevolution cannot happen, and yet I've proven this pathway of lizards to turtles. In other words, to defeat the claim of macroevolution is impossible, I don't have to prove that it actually occurred, I just have to have a theory that it can. Now, this is not someone who's uneducated, it's a PhD. But if we look nonsensical for saying, hey, I have a theory based on Genesis 1, and here's why I believe it, and here's even evidence to support why I believe it, and it is a theory, I'm willing to concede it's a theory. And we have to recognize the other side will do it, but let's both be honest and not say all I need is a theory to be right. You have a theory that you believe because of what you believe about you and the universe, and you are interpreting the data. You have a bias. Will we admit our bias is based on the Bible? Sure. Absolutely. Will we explore the opposite? I hope so, and be able to discuss. Absolutely. But I would encourage you to have confidence in the Word, confidence about the evidence that supports the Word. Realize some evidence along the way may not seem to support either side. Some seems to be against us, as it were. But realize you're not a weirdo and you're not a minority. The other side has the same, and I'm willing to even say, if not way more issues to consider as you walk through this issue of origins. So at the end of the day, everyone's working off of theories. Theories change, they're confirmed, they're debunked by new evidence. As we noted much earlier, how we interpret the evidence will largely be based on our worldview. So I'm encouraging you to take a position with the Word. And as you take your stand, recognize Genesis 1 not only gives insight to everything you see around you, everything you can even enjoy around you, but beyond that, it gives you a picture of a good God, a God that the Bible will present from chapter 1 onward, a God that is loving, a God that's intentional, a God that's interactive, a God that's even willing to intercede and intervene in your life. And he gave order and function and purpose because he's good, he's capable, and he's able. So it means that thought pattern you struggle with, the God of creation is able to help you with and overcome. That means the God that you read in Genesis chapter 1 is powerful enough to work in the relationship that's given you grief and you're struggling with. The God of Genesis chapter 1, who did all these phenomenal, incredible, impossible works, that same God is able to work in the heart of your unsaved family member or friend to draw them to their need for Christ, no matter how much they may reject him. My point tonight is, as we leave, is you may be super familiar with the creation narrative. You may be even somebody who says, I believe it. You're talking to the choir here. I get it. Then let's not leave off the creation narrative and forget that that God who created in the beginning is still as powerful today in what you're going through. He has not been diminished at all. He's not incapable in anything. So go to him. If you'd say, well, in the beginning, God, I believe it. But today, my fill in the blank. For today, it will just never change. Let's back up and go back to, if we can believe here, what's he not capable to do tomorrow? How can he not help you today? What can he not help you with from the past? What can he help you with in your uncertain future? If he's the God of creation and he is the God of conclusion, he is capable for everything in between. So brothers and sisters, go forward in confidence about your creative, caring God. I'm going to pray that we're going to be dismissed. I want to encourage you, be talkative, communicative with your family members about this, particularly parents. I would just challenge and encourage you to keep walking through these items. There are so many, of course, other rabbit trails and proofs and debunks we could go through, but we don't have the time for that, friends. that's for you to do some reading on your own. Some of it is incredibly fascinating. Some of it will bore you to tears, but it's helpful. It's good stuff. So let's do that this week. Let's pray.